Is the entire American reproductive and maternal health system broken? And if it is, how do we fix it? Those questions are at the heart of a provocative new book from a New York Times bestselling author.
There was also a kind of structural racism that the way in which the massive inequality between the resources at one hospital versus another, and thinking about how this brought to life the research that shows that a huge percentage of the racial gap in maternal mortality can be attributed to the hospital. That if a black woman goes to a hospital that primarily serves other black women, she's likelier to lose her life. Again, because of this pattern of disinvestment, of fear, of just abandonment that has persisted and that we've allowed to tolerate.
Our guest today is Irene Carmone, who has been praised for bringing a comprehensive understanding to women's health and justice issues that goes beyond the usual talking points. She's the author of Unbearable, Five Women and the Perils of Pregnancy in America.
One of the starting points of the book was the ways in which all these different experiences of pregnancy care and healthcare are deeply interconnected, even though they've been separated out. And so if you're reading a headline about somebody being forced to go septic before they can get access to an emergency abortion for a wanted pregnancy, and you're thinking, what? Like, what does this have to do with anything? It's because the complexity of medical decision making and also the ways in which these are political categories and not medical ones to say, you know, this is an abortion that's okay, this is an abortion that's not okay. I do think that that powerfully drew people's attention.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Irene, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, you write in your book, pregnancy can be a gift. It can be well worth the physical and emotional risk and transformations, but nothing can be truly be considered a gift when it comes wrapped in coercion or paternalistic silence. Those are strong words, and I'm wondering if you would further explain your views on it.
Of course. Well, so the inspiration for the book came out of my now 15 years of reporting on reproduction in America. Primarily, I focused on the American battle over access to abortion. I've reported on what's facing healthcare provision, on the experience of patients, a lot on the Supreme Court and how the Supreme Court has puzzled over these issues. And it wasn't until I actually became pregnant myself during COVID, the first time and the second time when Roe v. Wade was overturned, that I began to see the interconnection between what I'd been covering as a reporter, this almost kind of narrowly siloed issue of abortion that's treated as separate from other health care, and the rest of pregnancy care that, as you know, for reasons that are both medical, economic, but mostly political, have been separated out. And so I was actually 6 weeks pregnant and about to go on live television on MSNBC to talk about something that had been proposed in the Senate that day when the Dobbs decision leaked. And I had to react in a matter of seconds to what was happening live on the air with Chris Hayes on MSNBC, what's now MS Now. And when I had the chance to actually read what Justice Alito had written at a time when I myself was 6 months pregnant, he describes week by week fetal development. He's quoting the Mississippi law that is was at issue and was used as the vehicle to overturn 50 years of abortion jurisprudence. He describes the development of a fetus, and he says that at a certain point, you know, the fingernails, all of these different important physiological progressions, and he says at 12 weeks, the unborn child has taken on has taken on the human form in all relevant respects. And it was interesting to me sitting there, my very bones being moved happily, voluntarily. I was having a textbook pregnancy. I was so lucky in so many ways to have been able to choose to be pregnant, to get pregnant when I wanted to get pregnant, to have access to decent healthcare, to not have it destroy me economically or physically. At the same time, Pregnancy is such a profound human experience in any context. It's an experience inherently of transformation. And the idea to me that that would not be written into Justice Alito's week-by-week accounting, that he would completely disappear what pregnancy can mean to the individual who is pregnant, it filled me with outrage. During COVID, I had started to report on what was happening in hospitals around pregnancy in those immediate early days of really just kind of figuring out what to do with this new virus. And at the same time as I was covering the fallout from the Dobbs decision, I went to get an ultrasound, and I was kind of looking at this image. Again, I was very happy to be pregnant with who is now my second daughter. And the ultrasound tech heard me say to my husband, "Oh, she's starting to look more like a person now." And this person turned to the image of the fetus on the ultrasound and said, "You were a person from day one." And so what it crystallized to me is that although this person, you know, didn't have much power over me or my pregnancy, it was an instantiation of how when you become pregnant in the United States, the law has an opinion on the way it's going to go. Where you live depends on the kind of care you have access to. And that recognition of the humanity of the pregnant person is so foundational. And that includes the right not to be pregnant, and it also includes the right to be treated with care and respect when you choose to continue a pregnancy.
Well, thank you for sharing your personal story, as well as how you came to write this book based on your experiences and your many years of reporting. One of the things that you highlight is that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have released their reports that 80% of maternal deaths are preventable, and that for average, for Black women, on average, 50 people will die for every 100,000 who are pregnant. You bring these numbers to life with real stories in your book. I think this is an area where people's true stories are very helpful to people's understanding. So share with us, if you will, the story of perhaps one of the women that you profiled and the outcome.
Of course. So what I described was really the genesis of the book, but it is not a memoir and it is not a polemic. It is ultimately the story of five different women experiencing different pieces of the American reproductive system. And I wanted them to show different parts of a kind of broken pie or a broken story. And I knew that that would mean writing about the American South. In the end, it was Alabama, a place that's really foundational in American history, writing about a place that we think of as really restrictive when it comes to access to reproductive health care, perhaps maternity care deserts. All of these are really important factors in the maternal, in the unforgivable rate of maternal death in this country. But I also wanted to write about New York City. And I wanted to write about the place where I live because it is the wealthiest city. It is a blue jurisdiction where every law that a progressive would dream of is in place. And yet it is a place where the racial disparity in maternal mortality is starker than in the other place I wrote about in Alabama. And of course, you know, these numbers vary year by year. They are too large, but they are relatively, you know, sensitive to changes in year by year. But during the years that I wrote about, and New York has remained, year over year, has remained having a higher rate of racial disparity in maternal mortality than the country at large. So it's usually around three or four times, a Black woman is three or four times likelier to die for a pregnancy-related cause in the United States. During the time that I was writing this book, it was between 9 and 12 times likelier here in New York City. And I wanted to explore why that was the case. And I was interested in the public hospital system here in New York City, because during my reporting on hospitals during COVID, I learned that despite the fact that among a certain group of people in New York City, public hospitals are considered, oh, don't go there unless you really have to. But that there were pockets of a local hospital near me, Woodhull Hospital in Brooklyn, that were known for having a different standard of care for maternity. And that was specifically that the threshold care that you received was from midwives who were really committed to their patients, and they were seeing primarily Medicaid patients, and that everybody would get a private room, which, you know, is not a given in the New York City healthcare system. And during COVID, this felt very relevant. And so I was considering going to this hospital because another insane factor about being pregnant in 2020 was that there was a curfew and there were checkpoints relating to the protests that were happening that summer. And I was 39 weeks pregnant and I needed to get through potentially a checkpoint on my way to have this baby.
Gosh, yeah.
The checkpoint was listed like mere days before I had my daughter. So I ended up staying with my plan, but not transferring to this other hospital, Woodhull, which would have not required me crossing a checkpoint. But 2 weeks after I had my daughter, a young Black woman, Sha'Asia Semple, died in a completely preventable anesthesiologist malpractice. You know, this is a person who was later stripped of their license, but who had a pattern of poor care, negligent and harmful care. And I was crushed. And I thought, is this the way that we is understanding what's happened at this hospital, which I have been told offers something that many people have said is the key to solving these racial disparities, which is to say that the threshold care that people are getting is midwifery, that midwifery is integrated into the hospitals. But then how could something like this happen? And then it was, you know, what was described was that she needed an induction and that she was pressured into getting an epidural. And then the epidural was so poorly administered that it caused her life. And so I wanted to investigate Woodhull, but I needed to figure out how. And what ended up happening is that by the time I had really constructed this book, it was 2 years after Sha'Asia Semple, I met a woman in my community, a parent at my daughter's school, who told me that she had nearly died at Woodhull. And she was white, and she had been seeking a different kind of birth. She'd gone to a birth center. She'd ended up transferring to Woodhull because of the relationships that the midwives had. And then a mistake in her C-section that she ended up needing caused her to have a full-body hemorrhage. Have a hemorrhage that resulted in needing a full body blood transfusion. And this obviously shocked me to my core. And she didn't even know that I was working on a book where I was in conversations to try to interview folks at Woodhull where I really wanted to embed. But as shocking as this story was, she had made it out alive. And mere months after we had that conversation, a young woman named Christine Fields, a perfectly healthy 30-year-old mother, who had given birth without complication before at Woodhull Hospital, had a similar circumstance with an unplanned C-section, with an incision that was not properly closed, with a hemorrhage that was completely undetected. And both of these women had male partners who called for help, who said that something was wrong, who wanted to be at their side. But when Christine's partner, Jose, called for help, security was called on him. He is Latino. Christine is Black and had described a pattern the entire day of feeling ignored and overlooked when she felt like something was wrong with her pregnancy. She was first completely abandoned, and then everybody rushed in and started screaming at her about a C-section. She started having panic attacks. Jose was not allowed into the room during her C-section. So there was a pattern of events where, of course, there are differences always when it comes to medical care. There are difficult decisions that are being made. But suddenly, I had in front of me a story that told at least a piece of the story behind those statistics, which is that you had two healthy women who came to have C-sections due to arrested labor. In Christine's case, I think it was a fetal heartbeat issue. And how a failure to listen, a failure of follow-up, Christine was left alone completely without checkups. The error in the C-section was he attempted to repair it, but he never reported it. This pattern of neglect and both interpersonal racism and structural racism that left doctors who were known to be poor providers out of the fear that they wouldn't be able to get anybody else, left them to harm women and to end their lives as well. And so one of the things that I do in the book is that I explore that, you know, we tend to think of this as the kind of obvious interpersonal racism of, you know, of the story of Jose, which is, you know, why did they call security on him if he wasn't actually, all he was doing was trying to be at his partner's side during a pivotal moment and trying to support her. That's kind of, you know, a classic example of interpersonal racism. But there was also a kind of structural racism that the way in which the massive inequality between the resources at one hospital versus another, and thinking about how this brought to life the research that shows that a huge percentage of the racial gap in maternal mortality can be attributed to the hospital. That if a Black woman goes to a hospital that primarily serves other Black women, she's likelier to lose her life. Again, because of this pattern of disinvestment, of fear, of just abandonment that has persisted and that we've allowed to tolerate.
Thank you so much for shining a light on that. And it was heart-wrenching stories that really tell a bigger story. And Margaret, just thinking back, we've been providing maternity care for women for close to 40 years who live in poverty, and we do it through mobile vans and through midwives and the importance of that. And here in Connecticut, realize that, structural disconnect for so many women in getting healthcare is pronounced. And just wondering, as you pull the thread on that in terms of policy, Medicaid policy or other financial support, have you given thought to that of what fundamental package should be in place for women as they're trying to get the best quality care? And certainly the access to hospital data about outcomes is so important. We see that in so many different cases. I'm wondering what thoughts you've put into thinking about it from not only the personal side, but on the policy side.
Well, you know, I have heard from the reporting from the people that I've spoken to in the course of my reporting, of course, better integration of midwifery, but also, you know, making sure that when somebody does need a higher, more specialized level of care, that the doctors that are there, that there's accountability for them, that, you know, people are not just being shuffled around the system, which is something that took place in the places that I reported on. Higher rate of reimbursement for midwifery was something that came up again, too, just in terms of making this kind of work sustainable because it is so time intensive. Currently, at least in New York City, we do not know the rate of maternal death by hospital. We only know the aggregated data. And, you know, there is some sensitivity among the public hospitals that, you know, they have become scapegoated because the private hospitals have the ability to make these stories go away, you know, just by settling immediately or by having PR people who are really skilled at making these stories go away. So I would be very interested in seeing that data disaggregated by hospital, because I suspect that it would make hospitals and also, you know, severe maternal morbidity, because I suspect that we would see more accountability and not just rhetoric when it comes to this. But I do think that it's the sort of a story that we keep having to retell. You know, we've been telling it for a long time, and I think it needs to, you know, especially as the national policy is, you know, I'm talking about you know, places that are already trying to solve this problem. I'm really struck by the fact that, you know, as we speak, the Hep B vaccine the recommendation has just been removed. You know, that the country is being run by people who are talking about trying to force women to have more babies, whether it's by removing access to contraception or abortion or throwing them off Medicaid before they become pregnant. I feel like we actually do know many solutions, but that the national policy, everything is sort of driving towards making it more difficult, more coercive, having less information about it. I mean, I talked about disaggregating information from hospitals, you know, PRAMS, the reporting on maternal mortality being frozen right now, the collection being frozen. I can't help but link that to the fact that the people running the government right now just want women to have more babies or certain women to have more babies. So, you know, unfortunately, we're rolling backwards so quickly that a lot of this feels very pie in the sky.
You know, I think one of the things that we anchor on here is that we do know a lot about what makes a difference, right? We do know a lot. You talked about the importance of some of the nurse midwifery models with longstanding relationships, support during pregnancy, getting your questions answered, having people Listen, when you say something doesn't feel right, that's as sophisticated mm-hmm. as you need to get, really. Something doesn't feel mm-hmm. right. Listen.
Right.
And, yeah, and yet,
I mean, and the area time is care.
Right. The only, it's only, you know, I would say in recent years that we've really zeroed in on the fact that the most dangerous time may be after pregnancy, mm-hmm. after a delivery, mm-hmm. after a healthy delivery, in terms of complications, and that coverage kind of ends for most people at 6 weeks. That's now being mm-hmm. extended in some states mm-hmm. for up to 12 months. We know the problem with hypertension and not really aggressively, I would say, inadequately treating hypertension. I wonder, as you've been engaged in the study, have you found yourself expanding this period of time? Have you begun to look at that postpartum year and see if we have similar issues? What happens with the transitions to primary care? Tell us where else this has taken you in your journey.
Well, I mean, I want to exercise humility because I mostly want to hear from you guys what you think would be a solution. The postpartum story in my book, unfortunately, is the one in which criminalization is the factor, where, due to Alabama's classifying an embryo and a fetus as a person for the purpose of child abuse, the woman that I read about, Haley, instead of getting, and somebody who has struggled with postpartum depression, I might add, winds up being arrested 6 days postpartum in her son's hospital room, and sleeping on the floor of a jail is not anyone's idea of postpartum care, unless, of course, you are somebody who the state has decided needs to be punished. I'm also just really struck. I mentioned ways in which it's getting worse. You know, there's, as you say, we know the solutions. One of the solutions is not criminalizing abortion care, which is not a problem in Connecticut or New York, but I'm struck every day by fresh reporting about how emergency care and extremely high-risk care is being imperiled by restrictions on abortion. As you say, we do know what to do when it comes to this. But I think also, you know, I remember reading a CDC, a state maternal health mortality, maternal mortality investigator described the postpartum period as the postpartum person being treated as a candy wrapper to be thrown away. And unfortunately, I think that exemplifies the attitude that a lot of, she was describing, of course, an attitude she didn't endorse. But I think that describes a lot of the way this country treats people. And one of the things I've really wanted to do, if I ever end up writing a sequel to Unbearable, is a more solutions-oriented book, having, you know, really exposed the problem, that would go to other countries to see what they have done and wraparound care that doesn't just begin and end, you know, when you have a confirmed pregnancy, care, things like Medicaid expansion. Some of this is just political will. It's not really a mystery, right? But I think there are ways in which other countries have just figured this out. They just don't have these problems.
Well, I want to move from the policy to the politics. And we're talking about political will. We look at the polls about the most important issues to voters, and healthcare rarely is at the top of the list. Economic issues are usually number one. It's about the economy, stupid, right? I mean, and the Gallup poll found nearly half of the women say issues related to their health are not a priority at all among elected officials. I'm wondering, do you think political leaders have the willpower to fix things when they're not listening?
I mean, I think that they'll listen if people ask them to listen. There was a brief period, I felt like, after the Dobbs decision, where the public was deeply engaged on this issue writ large.
For a couple of years, right? There was all the result. Yeah.
Yeah, that there was political will on this. There was, at least in blue states, there was some accountability. In red states, there were state referenda. And I think also, you know, as people were noticing the impact of restrictions, they were also learning more about other kinds of maternity care. I think, you know, one of the starting points of the book was the ways in which all these different experiences of pregnancy care and healthcare are deeply interconnected, even though they've been separated out. And so if you're reading a headline about somebody being forced to go septic before they can get access to an emergency abortion for a wanted pregnancy, and you're thinking, what? Like, what does this have to do with anything? It's because the complexity of medical decision-making and also the ways in which these are political categories and not medical ones to say, you know, this is an abortion that's okay, this is an abortion that's not okay. I do think that that powerfully drew people's attention. I think, unfortunately, right now we live in an environment where the people who are hearing those stories are probably the people who are already predisposed to be upset about it. And I do really worry about our information environments providing a kind of confirmation bias where people aren't hearing stories that countervail their narrative and focus them. I really do worry that we live in an environment of so much chaos that it's impossible to figure out where to focus your attention. And so I do think that the kind of work that you're doing and the kind of work that is local and direct, like the people that I write about, like Jose Perez, Christine's widower, who is actually working as a doula now through a program for dads to focus with men of color, or like Dr. Yashika Robinson, who is providing maternal health care really at an incredibly high level despite enormous challenges. It feels like showing up and doing that work right now is one of the most powerful things that you can do while also trying to focus people's attentions on the crisis. It hasn't gone away just because it's gone away from the headlines. I mean, unfortunately, sometimes it just takes Trump saying something to focus people on it. And even then, it feels like it's for 15 seconds. But I my only hope is that this too shall pass because people are experiencing this in their own lives. I mean, pregnancy, for example, is something that, you know, I was astonished by this. Even now, when we hear all this panic about the birth rate, that the completed fertility rate, the number of people who have reached their end of their, the percentage of people who have reached the end of their reproductive age and have given birth is still 80% among women. And so this is an experience, it's still the most common reason that women are hospitalized. And so I think when people, regardless of their politics, are out there experiencing a system that could be so much better than it is.
So that's
only
that's
hope great... that even though they're tired and they're busy and they're distracted, that they can also try to imagine that it doesn't have to be that way, that it's not inevitable.
But if people are picking up your book, and I have a feeling your book is being picked up not just by women, but by lots of different folks, lots of different phases and stages of life, what's your hope for what people are going to do? There's obviously personal, political policy, but what is your hope for the impact that the book will have on people picking it up?
I mean, I hope that they will have more compassion for people who are not necessarily in the same situation as them. They might think, oh, well, it would never happen to me. I would never be addicted to drugs during my pregnancy, or I would make all of the perfect decisions about what kind of healthcare to pursue at any given time. Whereas in reality, it's a bigger systemic issue that is born out of a fundamental disrespect of, and that there are people out there who are trying to do something better and that we should be supporting their work and lifting up their work.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. The book is titled Unbearable, and the publisher is Simon & Schuster. Thank you all for listening today. And just to be a reminder to subscribe to our videos on YouTube and find us on Facebook or X. You can also share your thoughts and comments about this program. Take care and be well.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.